My name is Rusty Mackey, and you're listening to The Art of Stability. Hey, friends, I really hope you've been enjoying season two of the podcast. Listen, if you have, would you consider sharing your favorite episode with someone or maybe even writing a review? All this helps others to know about these amazing conversations. And speaking of amazing conversations, today I'm talking with Wynn Collier, author of many books and the director of the Eugene Peterson Center for Christian Imagination at Western Theological Seminary. Wynn is a deep soul who has suffered and somehow found beauty in it all. If something in you longs for beauty and to know love at a deeper level, then I believe this conversation is for you. So stay with us and enjoy Wide Open Spaces with Wynn Collier. When one of my first introductions to you was through your book, A Burning in My Bones, Eugene Peterson's biography, and something that struck me about you through reading that book was you really have a gift for taking facts, even facts that could be mundane, and writing about them in ways that is beautiful and soul-filling. Personally, you know, I started reading through that book and I was just plowing through, and then I thought, I need to slow down. And I actually did just that. I said, I'm just going to read this on my weekly Sabbath and I'm going to take it really slow and just savor, which is a big deal because I really don't like biographies. So I really just benefited and loved and enjoyed your work there. So thank you. And my question out of that is, have you always been drawn to finding beauty in the mundane? And if so, why do you think that is?
Well, thank you for noticing that. I appreciate it. And for taking it during your Sabbath, that feels like a real gift. So thank you. I don't know that I've always known that I liked finding beauty in the mundane. Like, I don't know that I knew to call it that. But yes, I think that's true. When I was a kid growing up, I had a really interesting childhood. My dad was a traveling evangelist. And so we lived in a fifth wheel travel trailer, moving from town to town every week. And I remember the most simple things, like driving early on a Saturday morning, you know, my dad and I in the front of the truck by ourselves with my sister and mom in the back in the trailer, and, you know, sunrises over just long, endless seeming miles of cornfields. And
wow.
And then being in Washington, D.C. and being overwhelmed by like just the smells and the energy and, I still remember some of the tiniest towns we would go to. Covington, Indiana is one that strikes me. And it was, there was something that I noticed about Wimpy's Donuts and Charlene Galloway, who was the librarian who took me to lunch at the little town square. You know, I'm probably 8 or 9 years old, and those small details have always seemed beautiful to me. And yeah. I couldn't tell you why. I don't know. Other than maybe once you've tasted it or seen it, you see more of it. And I think the details of life are where the magic is.
Yeah. So the seed was definitely there from the earliest of age. I mean, you think about essentially a never ending road trip as a family, which would not be necessarily a positive experience for a lot of children. And yet you're seeing beauty in it. But you also mentioned that you don't know if you've always known that about yourself. So what was there a defining moment where you began to realize, oh, I actually have a knack for this, especially maybe even in the field of writing, you know, knowing that you're such a gifted writer. Was there a moment where you just realized, like, I really love seeing beauty and then drawing other people's attention to it?
Well, if we're talking about where I started to realize it, I think it probably wasn't in my own writing. I think I recognized it more when I was reading to other people. And I would find myself, like, there'd be some tiny little detail and not overdone, because that's another mistake that we often make, particularly writers. Like, we take a beautiful thing and then we overdo it. So someone who wasn't trying too hard to paint a beautiful picture, but was just letting me in to what they see and they smelled and they saw, someone's slight mannerisms, or that little whiff of sandalwood, and you're like, oh, I know that smell, you know, and and just realizing, oh, I'm drawn into that. And then I found myself wanting to write like that too. And and I always think that it's, you know, a big bulky guy might be walking down the street, and that's one thing, but if he has a little gait, like his knee is wounded, or like that gives me a whole nother side of a picture for this character. And so, I mean, in love and in parenting and friendship, in food, I mean, it's always the really particular little thing that makes something what it is. And, so I think maybe in its simplest sense, it's just me scratching after trying to discover what's the essence of something, what's the reality of something, and then wanting to offer someone else the capacity to see the essence of something too.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, as you're sharing this, just this notion of all of life is sacramental is coming to mind. And really this learned ability to pay attention to, as you're saying, the essence of something, to be able to discern that it's there to begin with, and that it's not overdone, you know, in terms of the craft of writing, which takes a lot of restraint to not overdo a good thing, as you said. When it comes to just becoming more aware of the beauty of life, the sacramental nature of it, what's that journey been like for you?
Well, it's when I was a pastor in South Carolina, so probably 22 years ago or something, would be the moment where I first was carried into the actual realm of sacramental theology, where I was reading and it was being explained to me what this vision of and this way of participating in the world is. But the moment that door opened for me, I didn't need to be coaxed in. No one needed to convince me. It was as if I was already there. I just didn't have the language for it. So in a way, I think the way I had experienced the world, the way that God had drawn me into the world, I definitely think the books that I had read, the stories I had entered, I was already, without having any comprehension of it, I think my heart was already seeing the world sacramentally. And then someone explained to me what that was. And now all of a sudden I understood this was bigger than I had imagined, that this was more wedded to the grandest story that had won my heart, the story of Jesus and his love for the world that was never ending. And all the times where I'd been moved by tears and joy and been disturbed by evil, and all of these things begin to make sense to me. Other sort of theological ideas about the world just being temporary in its deepest sense, you know, or that God's care for the trees and the cultures and the beauties, that was a distraction. Like that just never rang true to me. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is why. I mean, God loved all of the world, the world so much, that he, in the big arc of human redemption, that we're all getting redeemed, creation, and this all matters. And I'm like, oh yeah, I believe that.
it is such an eye-opening moment. If it's the eye-opening moment of discovery for the first time, or discovering something and getting words for what you've lived, just this like, oh, I'm looking at the world in a whole new way. And the Lord is all in the mix of it, bringing about his story, that grand story that you were talking about. And yet in the middle of those, that big story, we experience pain from time to time too. And so I'd love to hear, if you're willing, a story of a season of instability when you experienced some pain, and how did you navigate that season of instability?
You know, if this is all right, Brush, right as you were talking, I was, a friend of mine had, Colossians is one of my favorite passages of scripture. And a friend of mine this morning, he texted me this little section from Colossians in Eugene's from The Message. Is it okay if I read it?
Please.
I just think it speaks to some of what we were just talking about. We look at this Son, Jesus, and see the God who cannot be seen. We look at this Son and see God's original purpose in everything created. For everything, absolutely everything, above and below, visible and invisible, rank after rank after rank of angels, everything got started in him and finds its purpose in him. He was there before any of it came into existence and holds it all together right up to this moment. And when it comes to the church, he organizes and holds it together like a head does a body. He was supreme in the beginning, and leading the resurrection parade, he is supreme in the end. From beginning to end, he's there, towering far above everything, everyone. So spacious is he, so expansive, that everything of God finds its proper place in him without crowding. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. I think that's beautiful. And when Colossians says everything that's from God, which means everything, finds itself collected together in Jesus without crowding. Jesus is somehow so expansive that within his reality, everything that exists finds its true reality. And so when you ask about instability, I mean, that's part of what Paul is speaking to, is that even though this world seems to be breaking into a million pieces, that it actually is held together in Christ, that's the deep reality. And that's the hope. So in my own story, when you ask about times of instability, I almost want to, there's a little part of me wants to say, well, it's just my life.
Yep.
But if I'm just picking, you know, one of the first ones that comes to mind was the first couple of years our boys were born. Our boys are 16 months apart. And I was pastoring a university church in Clemson, South Carolina, that was beautiful and chaotic. And it was like 85% college students. So it was,
wow.
There was a ton of beautiful energy. And then it was just, there wasn't a lot of help. And we had to raise money to eat. Miska and I had 4 years of wonderful marriage without kids, just the two of us. And we got really tight. And then all of a sudden, two boys disrupted all that. And
yeah.
And accompanying with that, I went through a really, really long stretch of a profoundly dark season spiritually, just a crushed heart and crushed hope and a lot of shame. And it began to spiral. And so for several years, I was just internally in lots of ways. I was really struggling. And all I know to say is that love carried me somehow in that. I mean, I did all the things we're supposed to do, mostly. I talked to wise counselors and spiritual director, and I tried to be healthy and get plenty of sleep. And I mean, some of us struggle to tend to our heart and to the deep things inside of us, and then others of us obsess over them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I could probably play both sides of that depending on the mood I'm in. Mm-hmm. So I definitely kept talking to Miska, my wife, and I cried out to God. Sometimes I was really, really pissed because it didn't seem to me like God was doing a whole lot. I think I just kept coming back home and I kept being allured by love. And yeah.
It strikes me with your story how there were a few things that were definitely challenging. You know, the stress of a young church, not a lot of help, raising money for your food. There was definitely the spiritual darkness and weightiness that you were experiencing. But at the same time, there was a lot of good going on in your life that was also creating some instability. You know, the boys coming along, and of course, you love them with everything you got, but it still was a source of destabilization, right? And I'm struck as you're sharing this, your story, that's, I think, so relatable to so many, because it does. It has so many factors of just life at play in it, which is what can be so overwhelming for so many of us. And then I'm also reflecting on, you know, the translation from Colossians by Eugene. And I just love how Eugene so regularly uses that word expansiveness in his translations, you know, and we'll take that, especially the Hebrew word for salvation, and, you know, he'll translate it as a wide open space, an expansive place. And so there's something to salvation where it is expanding us, right? And it's inviting us into wide open places with God. So I'm curious, as you were continuously lured by love, coming home to love, how did you find God expanding you in that season? And what were some of the natural overflow, some of the fruit of that expansion?
One thing that I didn't say very clearly was the reason why some of this was happening when our sons were born was because I discovered new layers of selfishness within me. Mm. So when before, you know, Miska and I had this intensity where we were just like maybe too enmeshed in some ways. Now all of a sudden, most of her attention was trying to keep two boys alive. And then she was getting exhausted and I was having my darkness, and it just, yeah, it made our marriage, while it's always been a good marriage, it just, it was unstable. It was unsettling. Because this thing that had before been absolute rock now felt shakier, you know? And, but a lot of that was because of my own selfishness. So as I, as I began to recognize that, some of the expansiveness was what naturally happens whenever you become less obsessed with yourself and you learn again what it means to love. And you think, oh, I made vows and promises that I was going to love Miska and in every season. And that means I don't get to demand things from her. And then as I'm enduring this, you know, years long grappling with shame and pain, and it made me a different person. It made me a different pastor. It made me a different writer. Sometimes it's hard to talk about without, you know, lapsing into cliches, but I don't know. People sometimes ask, you know, they'll hear my story and they say, well, how did you end up where you did? And usually the answer that comes to my mind is, well, I suffered a fair bit of pain. Mm. I mean, pain has a way of putting certain things to death and resurrecting other things and clarifying things. And I think my compassion for others, my capacity to receive and experience deeper depths of like the human condition are now more available to me because I've felt it. I've experienced it. Even when I'm with someone who has a completely radically different story than, and the particulars than I do, I'm often able to feel some of their agony or their question or the torment or or their just unrelenting clinging to hope. And I'm like, oh, that is familiar to me. You know, I know that. And as a writer, I mean, like, if you don't know the human condition, then just stop, you know? And I think the same should be true of pastors. And, and yet too often, too many of us, we fall prey to the temptation to just give people a quick answer or manage people into a, you know, religious exercise and build a religious organization. But if you are inefficient enough to be with people in their depths, I mean, that's a whole other kind of goodness.
It truly is. And we've all experienced the goodness of being cared for. At least I hope we all have, sitting with someone where they truly listen and they are with us. You can just sense like you're with me in this. Versus you're here to fix me or move me along. And so that makes so much sense. And I'm struck by exactly what you said, just how the Lord used suffering to expand your soul, expand your experience. And how often when we think of the expansion seen there in Colossians or God bringing us into wide open places, we just think, oh, we're just frolicking in fields, you know, it's just this happy experience. And certainly that happens from time to time, but man, the Lord does, there's something about suffering that the Lord uses in us to expand us, to make us the people who can receive and give love is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. And, you know, in 2 Corinthians, Paul says that he suffered with some of the overflow of the sufferings of Christ, which is a mysterious statement itself, but then that those sufferings would overflow to the Corinthians for their comfort. That's a quite a powerful flow that in some ways we who've been called into the healing ministry of Christ, those of us who've been called into serving the body of Christ, that we participate if we'll let ourselves in Christ's suffering for the good of the healing of those that God has called us to be with. And I don't know what that always looks like, but I think I know enough to I've tasted at least a little hint of that.
Yeah. I'm so grateful that you said that, because a lot of the pastors that I find myself working with, as suffering comes, as they experience pain, it seems like half of our work is helping them grapple with the shock that they're experiencing suffering and pain so that we can then actually get to working with the actual pain, right? There's just something about, I don't know if it's a generational thing, but there's just something about this surprise, even though Jesus said, like, if you are my followers, you will suffer. The scriptures tell us like suffering is coming as part of the deal, as part of the package. When, as you are in a space now, different space than you were back then, whole new city, working at Western, you've got the Eugene Peterson Center. Surely you have plenty to keep you busy with your life now. In the midst of all of that, what are some things, some practices that you've incorporated into your life right now that's helping you to continue to enjoy Jesus and to really bring your life into that expansiveness that Christ has to offer for us?
Well, nothing that feels like rocket science. It feels plain. It's like the things that lead to a good life, you know. I mean, practicing Sabbath with my wife as often as I'm able, doing morning prayers from the Book of Common Prayer, having meaningful conversations with friends, and I mean, exercise is really important for me. It's funny. The thing I love to do is to run, even though I'm not really a runner. Like I don't have a runner's body. And if you watch me run, no one looks at Wynn and goes, oh, there goes a runner.
But you're doing it.
But there is something about being outside, the length of time, the cadence, the way it clears my head. I love walking and hiking. Miskas and my, our favorite kind of vacation is walking tours. Like we've done one in Scotland, two in Ireland.
Yeah.
Those kind of spaces. I mean, good books. I mean, you just can't, a good book, you know, Living the Christian Year. Yeah.
It strikes me that your answer to this question is very tied to where we started the conversation with a lot of mundane things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not rocket science. I'm reading through my prayers in the morning, afternoon, and evening. I'm Sabbathing weekly. I'm trying to be consistent in my exercise. And but there's a beauty there too, right? I mean, there's a beauty in these rhythms that, as you say, lead to a good life. So walk me through for you as you're just, you're doing your routine. You're doing your best to live into these healthy rhythms. What does it look like to find beauty and specifically to behold, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord there in those ordinary, mundane routines that you have?
I think it's gratitude. My wife's a spiritual director and a yoga teacher. And so she's roped me into the world of yoga, which, you know, if you're to look at Wynn and say he's not a runner, you definitely would look at Wynn as a yoga person. But I trust her. And there's some things, particularly one of the kinds of yoga she teaches has been really, really good for me. But on Thursday mornings early, we'll usually do yoga together. And we're in this little three-season room at the back of our house, windows on three sides. We're looking out into the woods. The sun will usually be just peeking up orange, a little orangey over the horizon through the woods. If it's cold, which here in Michigan, much of the year it is, you know, yeah, we'll have the little stove burning. And one of the first things Misko will usually say is, notice something that you're grateful for. And then at the end, she'll usually say, with your hands sort of up in prayer, she'll say, recall that thing that you're grateful for. And to me, that frames that time as a space of prayer. Because for me, when I say I'm grateful for something, that doesn't just mean I have the warm emotion. It means that there's something that I'm recognizing that the triune God has brought such beauty or goodness or life into this world that I'm surrounded by good gifts. And gratitude is my way of answering God and saying, yes, you did this. Thank you. It's a way of hallowing the place where I am. So,
yeah.
And I think that's just true. Even if I'm not like verbally or even like explicitly in my own mind saying, thank you, like walking around like that would probably feel a little goofy. It's a posture of gratitude of like, I can let go. I can unclasp my hands. I don't have to control and manage this relationship or this place of anxiety. I can live with gratitude to God who is before me and behind me and holds all things together.
I love this really rhythm that you have even within your rhythms. There, you know, this requires discipline. So you have to actually have the discipline to have these habits in place and to continue to do them. And then there's the noticing that is kind of baked into who God has made you, but is good for all of us to just pay attention and to notice while you're actually in that habit, which is so helpful for embodying it. And then if you feel it or not, I love that distinction. You know, gratitude's not always a feeling, but you have determined in your heart, I'm going to have this posture of gratitude towards the Lord. So it's kind of this baked in, like you've already planned your work of how am I going to respond to God and what he's doing in this moment? Well, it's going to be gratitude. So I love that combination of, it's really intentionality, right? Of here's the discipline of the habit, the noticing, and the gratitude. And I think something else that I see in you is just, and I would imagine this comes out of your story, is just, I see, sense this hopefulness from you. And I can't help but think that part of that is due to these rhythms that you have in your life. So as I'm thinking, and I'm sure you could too, about folks who may be listening and they're hopeless, and even just the idea of finding discipline for habits or noticing the Lord in a moment or choosing a posture of gratitude, they might be in a space where that sounds really hard for them. What would your advice be to someone who's walking through a season of hopelessness? How would you encourage them?
Yeah, I probably would be slow with advice. And for me, at least, I probably wouldn't start with, at least the person that comes to mind, like this person who is hopeless, feels hopeless and is spent. And I probably won't start with practices for them. I probably would start with a pronouncement that God is the God of hope and that God raises things from the dead. And we don't have hope in hope. We have hope in the one who makes hope happen. I wouldn't challenge someone toward hope. I would tell them that the God who was loving them before the founding of creation is already bringing into being the life and the hope that they do hope for. That story is happening, whether they feel it or don't feel it, experience it or don't experience it, that the gospel story is the story of what God has done and is doing across time and history. And so then I would just, you know, if it were right now, I'd be like, we're actually entering into a season that's all about this pretty soon. It's called Advent. And you know what? Jesus is coming.
Yeah.
You couldn't stop it if you wanted to. Your lack of hope couldn't possibly derail the coming kingdom of the living Christ. Mm. So if you want, take off your gloves and get warm by the fire, because the fire burns, you know. I do think the older I get, and I'm not saying there's not a time for it, but I give fewer and fewer admonitions, and I more and more offer declarations, because I think that's ultimately where the hope is, because I've been in that place where I couldn't gin up any hope.
That's right.
If Jesus didn't rescue me, then I was finished.
Hmm. And as you said earlier, even when everything seems like it's falling apart, Jesus is expansive and big enough to somehow hold it all together. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and for this conversation. Thank you for your gift of writing and declaring beautiful truth to people when they need to hear it. Grateful for you and your ministry. So thanks for being here today, Wynn.
Well, thank you, Rusty. It was really generous of you to invite me. And yeah, thank you for hosting a genuine conversation.
All right, everybody. Thank you for hanging with us until the very end. Check out the show notes to find out how to get connected with Wynn, and I'll add a link to his Eugene Peterson biography, A Burning in My Bones, which I highly recommend. I'll also add a link to his work at the Eugene Peterson Center. You know, in my work with leaders, I understand how challenging leadership is in today's world, and this is why I started the Leaders Toolbox newsletter. Sign up today at steadfastmin.com, that's steadfastmin.com/newsletter, to get weekly practices and tools to help you become a more grounded leader in today's shifting world. The Art of Stability is a production of Steadfast Ministries that exists to help you stay grounded in Christ to lead with confidence and clarity. The cover art was created by Brian Bim. Music created and performed by Rob Main, and the music was recorded and produced by the Astros Company. Thank you for joining me, and I'll see you next time on The Art of Stability.